I'd like to thank Martin for, first of all, having the idea of organizing the session, and then secondly, for thinking of me to include in the program. I'd like to acknowledge my co-author on this, Carrie Dunfield, who is a soil microbial ecologist. My background is actually in micrometeorology, and you may ask yourself, what am I doing here? The question is, or the answer to this is that I've worked a lot with measuring nitrous oxide fluxes, and I'm not a true micrometeorologist in the sense that often micrometeorologists are only interested in measuring the fluxes and working on the techniques to measure it, and then once they have that figured out, they move to another compound, so to speak, or another trace gas. I, because of my background, some background in soil science, I've always been very interested in linking what we're measuring with what is happening in the soil. So I will walk you through some of our past work, first give you a bit of a background, and some of our results emphasizing the importance of non-growing season N2O fluxes, and some specific studies that we've done with tracers and soil heat pulse probes and as well microbial communities. So as we probably all know, that the freezing of soils results in enhanced N2O fluxes at thawing. This is a soil column experiment that we did where we froze soils from all directions, just meaning that it froze solid, in a unidirectional froze freezing where it froze more like it happens in the field from top to bottom, and you can see the difference in the temperature measured at 1 and 20 centimeters in these soil cores. And not surprisingly, others have shown that you do get a much larger N2O flux, shown here in nanograms per meter square per second, when you freeze, when you have more freezing. So the intensity of freezing duration as well as the temperature to which the soil cores freeze influences what then happens once these cores are thawed, as shown here. So this has been associated with microbial activity, mostly denitrification. And there have been a lot of lab studies showing how sterilized cores we don't get these high N2O fluxes in cores that have been previously sterilized. It is difficult to set up realistic conditions in lab studies. Obviously, we do learn a lot from individual controlling factors, but things like the amount of snow cover or snow melt really requires us going out to the field to measure these emissions in situ. And we would like to do that year-round to understand the mechanisms relating these enhanced N2O fluxes in cold climates. So our main field study site consists of four large plots. They have to be large, of the order of about 1.5 hectares, within a larger area in order to apply the micrometeorological methods. This site is, the characteristics are given there. The important part is that the minimum temperature, air temperature, is below zero for a large part of the year, between November and April. We do have some snow cover, at least not very extensive, but for about 65 days on average, we have a snow cover above 5 centimeters. It's an agricultural research site where, and the method that we use is the flux gradient method that where we've applied sort of this intermediate between the typical micromet method, which is eddy covariance, which is one large field, and agronomic or other types of studies where you have a lot of fields where you can do combination of factors. We can do about four plots within a very large 30-hectare area, and this shows some of the tubing that is used to bring the sample back to a trailer where all the instrumentation is placed. And we can do a comparison, as I said, of four plots. So a lot of the next few slides that we'll be talking about have referred to this long-term, and when I mean long-term, is was conducted over 5 years, study where we compared different crop manage or soil and crop management practices on these four plots. We started off in 2000 comparing conventional practice, which was a combination of tillage, nitrogen rates, a general nitrogen rate, compared to best management, which was no tillage, an N rate based on soil N test, so a reduced N rate and cover crop in one of the years of the study. And after 2005, we changed back to just having tillage as the difference in treatment with the same nitrogen rate applied. The instrumentation or the samplers are shown here. The flux gradient method is based on measuring a difference in concentration between these two heights and then deriving these other parameters, which I'm not going to get into, but deriving those from from sonic anemometer and cup anemometer measurements. There is some data gap filling that has to happen because we do not, under low wind conditions, we don't get good measurements. The trailer looks something like this. We use a tunable diode laser, trace gas analyzer, where part of the samples get directed to and measure concentration at a rate of 10 hertz, so 10 samples a second, and we end up with half-hourly averages of flux per plot. Okay. So we're able to measure year-round, except, of course, for times when things go wrong, but that's research. And a view of our fields when the crops are present or after harvest. So just an overview of results shown here over these 4 years, sorry, 5 years. So corn in 2000 followed by the spring thaw. So we our year is from May of 1 year to April of the next year, so that the spring thaw that happens is related to the crop that was there the year before. So crops are typically planted in this region in May. And the rotation is corn, soybean, wheat, corn, soybean, and then the mean over the 5 years is shown here. And growing versus non-growing season values, where the non-growing season goes from November to April. So the first thing I like to highlight here is that, as already mentioned, the non-growing season emissions are quite important, are the blue bars, and can be anywhere from 24 to 88% of the annual emissions. Management affects the emissions. We had significant differences in 4 out of the 5 years. And most of that reduction in terms of the best management was related to things happening from November to April as opposed to during the growing season. So a lot of the mitigation practices that are being looked at in terms of reduction of N2O emissions for agricultural soils in cold climates probably should be also looking at what is happening over this cold period. And why is that? So if just a picture of the two practices during winter time. And the first thing, if you notice, and it's actually already been mentioned here for the Arctic conditions, that when you have some vegetation or stubble and so on that traps snow, and we get higher thickness of snow in the no-till, and that results in higher soil temperature during winter under the no-till, which has a lot of implications, obviously, for soil microbial activity. But in terms of N2O, the important part here is that we get less freezing under the no-till conditions, and that will affect the emissions that we get at thaw. So in the this can be illustrated very clearly here, where we're comparing the two types of tillage practices. For the two plots, these are basically replicates of the same treatment. And starting in January, we do get quite a bit of short period thaws. I'm going to just focus on the main thaw event and go from the daily fluxes to hourly fluxes, highlighting how the no-till had much less emissions, lower peak and shorter duration compared to conventional till. When we put all of that information into one graph where we have the accumulated November to April nitrous oxide emissions, and each data point is 1 year, so one is for 2001, so on, 2005, and the squares are conventional, and the diamonds best management practices. And we related this to accumulated degree hours below zero, so that gives us a measure of, in the soil, obviously, a measure of how cold or of how frozen the soil was. So lower values, it's warmer, and higher values, it's colder. And we see that for our conditions, over those 5 years, a lot of the N2O emissions were explained by this sort of degree of freezing, meaning if you have very cold condition, we do have one outlier here in 2003, was a very cold year where the snow cover came after a month of cold weather, so it got very cold in the soil, and then the thaw emissions were much larger, just like you see with soil cores when you freeze them longer or at lower temperature. When you thaw the soil core, you get a higher flush. The other thing I want to point out, that all of these soils had less nitrate, or less than 10 milligrams of N per kilogram of nitrate. When we superimposed some earlier work that was published back in 1998, we do get alfalfa plowed down and fall manure application get much higher emissions for the same amount of freezing degree hours. And here, this is a grass with very low nitrate, doesn't fit that as well. Now, obviously, we don't expect this exact relationship to hold everywhere. There are other factors at play, but for our site, this seems to explain a lot of the variation, and these are more recent 2007, 2006 data points. You can see the diamonds grouping at the lower values here, and the squares, which is the conventional tillage, getting much colder and higher emissions as well. And just for fun, I plotted some data that we obtained in Manitoba in collaboration with Mario on here, and we see that obviously this doesn't explain everything, so it's good. We still have lots of work to do to try to explain these emissions. And just emphasizing again, so if we put all of this conventional till and no-till data, we do have this one outlier here, but on average, 33% of decrease of emissions due to this lower freezing hours that we see here for the no-tillage. Okay, so this is a bit of the background as what we've learned with our field emissions. The mechanisms that have been suggested for this increase or this enhanced flux at thaw are related to the fact that we may have newly produced N2O, meaning that the freezing conditions, so more freezing, could really result in additional nutrient availability. And obviously, we have very anaerobic conditions with ice and snow melt. And as well, it has been proposed that you do have some denitrification, but that's incomplete denitrification. So our N2O to N2 ratio is quite high. In addition, we may have, in contrast, you may have a little bit of N2O produced all those days during winter, and then when it thaws, all of that gets released. So an increased freezing degree hours, for example, could be related to both of those proposals, because if you have more freezing, you have more trapping of that N2O that gets produced through the winter. And that could be either in deep soil layers or more at the surface. This suggestion for the release of N2O from deep soil layers started with that, with experiments that measured nitrous oxide concentration with depth, and what you see is a huge buildup of nitrous oxide at 20 or 30 centimeters. So it's only logical that you would think that maybe some of that N2O would end up at the surface, and that it would explain the high N2O emissions. That's a cool effect. Sorry. Was it because I went like this? Sorry. Or, of course, we could have the combination of these factors, right, and at different times. So the tracer experiment that one of our PhD students did was to take undisturbed soil cores in it was actually in December, and it was taken only in a no-till plot because the soil was very frozen under the conventional till. He couldn't get a soil core. And then take them back to the lab and add a label nitrate at 60% excess, and then take it back to the field and sort of just leave it there. So it froze just like the surrounding soil. And we labeled it, or we called this surface or deep layer addition of the tracer. And what we got was at thaw then, this is day 80, so in end of March, we got a much higher, much more of the N2O produced in the surface layer was lost as a flux than in the deep layer. And this happened even though we had much higher N2O concentrations at depth. So we suggested that perhaps that high N2O at depth, as it either could diffuse, or sorry, be carried with leaching down, or as it was diffusing, partly would be further reduced to all the way to N2. It's more a higher diffusion path or longer diffusion path. So that then showed to us that it wasn't any N2O trapped at depth, maybe a little bit of a contribution, but that mostly perhaps it was de novo denitrification contributing. So we tried to go after that hypothesis. But first I want to show the importance, of course, of these mechanisms for modeling. So the DNDC model, which is considered the only model that actually describes these freeze-thaw N2O emissions, is shown here, the values in pink, and it's all the idea underlying it is ice-trapped N2O, and it's obviously not correct. It's the timing is wrong, the amount is wrong, so it was an easy fix because it just meant removing that algorithm from the model. It's just to say there isn't really any ice trapped. If it's trapped at depth, it doesn't really make it to the surface. And so we've focused our attention to the top surface layer, and we were really interested in seeing how water phase changes and how that relates to the N2O flux. For that, we used heat pulse probes, and these probes have been designed for measurement of soil heat flux, but also, and you can deduct the apparent heat capacity. So they work by having a heater, and I lost my, okay, a heater in the center that releases a pulse that gets detected by thermistors on either side. If the soil is going in between those probes is undergoing phase change, the heat will be consumed during the phase change, and we get very extreme apparent heat capacity values, many orders of magnitude higher than the regular values. And just illustrating that concept then is we have our half-hourly N2O flux, and the apparent heat capacity on this scale. So typical soils are between 2 and 3, maybe up to 4 for forest water. And we get, in this case, then going from presumably ice, because it's a cold period, to a very high heat capacities, indicating that this is when we're having phase change in the soil. And I'd like to illustrate this beautiful in sync with the phase change, showing us that as, you know, liquid water becomes available, there is some emission. Now, this is probably a bit too fast for microbial activity, so our idea is maybe there's some physical effect here, and perhaps a de novo microbial activity once we get more water available at 5 centimeters. We have some new results. One of my graduate students will be presenting this for those interested, where we've looked at storage of nitrous oxide gas in the profile and trying to relate that to the N2O flux. In terms of the microbial work, Carrie Dunfield and I had a student that looked at microbial communities. She had a February sampling date sometime here and March sampling, and saw an increase in the diversity of microbial community diversity between those 2 dates. However, that was just looking at diversity and not abundance or activity of those communities. So the work that we've done in recent years is related to trying to link those functional genes in the nitrogen cycle to the N2O fluxes. And here I'm getting into a bit of a slippery slope, sorry, because I'm not a microbial ecologist and I'm going to be presenting these results. And I joked with Claudia, who's going to speak after me, that she can answer my questions, the other Claudia, about any questions you may have on this. So we targeted the NER-S and AMO-A and NOS genes, and this is work of Deanna, our master's student, and did both DNA and RNA extractions. And the issue there, though, was particularly with the RNA determination, was to when to go out to sample. Right, so those are very expensive substrates that you have to use to preserve the RNA. So I thought I'd ask people here, when would you go out? We have the snow depth and surface temperature as measured with an infrared thermometer. So that gives us an idea of the top layer. And, you know, any takers of the question? When would you go out if you want to catch those microbial communities?
Day 70.
Yes, you passed the test. Okay, so this is what we did. We went out at those times, shown here with the arrow. Actually, in hindsight, would have been good to go a bit earlier as well. The issue, of course, is that you never know when the spring thaw is going to happen, right? So you don't have the privilege of having this graph, but you do measure. We can't see the snow depth, snow cover disappearing, and we did have the infrared thermometer, so we could be seeing if the temperature was going up, and then we also looked at the forecast. So if the forecast was, well, it's going to get warm now, okay, we'll go out and maybe we lucked out a little bit. Anyway, So those were the days we went out for sample. Oh, actually, that was the royal we. I didn't go out for sampling. The student went out for sampling. And this is when the fluxes occurred. So we were happy with that result, although, as I said, it would have been nice to go out at this time period. And what we see is that a lot of, we already get increases in fluxes even when the temperature is just approaching 0 degrees for a very small layer. I'm not going to get in more detail with this. The difference between the two plots was that residue was removed and residue returned. So the black is the one with no residue, which it was also a lot wetter, like lower structure in the soil, very sort of muddy at the time. And we wanted some contrasting fields to try to relate the microbial abundance to these fluxes. And I, in the next few slides, will just give you a view of what these fields looked like during this time of enhanced fluxes. So the first sampling, a few days later, see lots of bubbles there, March 11th, very hard to walk on. So you wouldn't really be taking many gas chamber measurements, for example, and it would be very difficult to do that. And then at this day, it's starting to drain a bit, but it was wet for a number of days after that. Okay, so I'm only going to show the NAS active community over time. So we have DNA and RNA for the two plots. And there was a significant trend with time for DNA, but not for RNA, although it does, at first we thought, okay, this we do see a trend here, but it wasn't significant because of a lot of variability in the data. These are expressed in terms of log gene copy numbers per dry soil. These are average overall for all the sampling dates. We see that, and that's DNA, we see significant differences between the two plots in all three gene abundances for DNA and also in the RNA. Always lower, there's a typo here, but lower abundances for the one with no residue. And the N2O flux was negatively correlated with abundance of NAS, so all our residue returned plots, data points clustered down here with low N2O flux, and the no residue clustered up here with high flux, low gene abundance. So this leads us to conclude that perhaps incomplete denitrification as a mechanism for the N2O flux at thawing, with obviously a lot of substrates and perfect conditions in terms of denitrification occurring at that time. So my concluding remarks are we've seen more intense soil freezing during winter, inducing large N2O fluxes at thaw, and that management can decrease the intensity of soil freezing. I call this a sort of positive side effect of no tillage in addition to carbon addition. Denitrification in the surface layer as triggered by thawing was source of N2O, not release of trapped gases at depth. And it does seem to be induced with water phase change, so liquid water becoming available in the surface layer. And we've seen that both nitrifier and denitrifier communities were quite active over the spring thaw, indicating de novo denitrification, a source of N2O, and differences in gene activity and N2O fluxes in two contrasting plots suggest incomplete denitrification as the mechanism. And with that, I'd like to thank you. and all funding and students and co-workers.